Welcome to Real Money with David Holland, the show that focuses on real people, real problems, and real solutions. Unlike a lot of radio and TV personalities, David is a certified financial planner with over 20 years of financial experience. And because he actually provides advice to clients on a daily basis, our hyperactive compliance department wants us to tell you that David Holland is an investment advisor representative of Holland Advisory Services, a registered investment advisory firm. He also offers insurance and annuity products through Holland Insurance Services. Holland Advisory Services and Holland Insurance Services are separate affiliated companies that share common ownership under Holland Financial. Commentary given during this radio program is usually pretty smart, but should not be considered investment, insurance, tax, or legal advice. Views expressed concerning specific securities should not be considered an offer to buy or sell. Investment advice and financial planning services can only be given after an analysis of an individual's situation, only if you hire David and his firm to help you, and only available where Holland Advisory Services is registered or exempt from registering. And now, brace yourself. Ladies and gentlemen, here comes the unfiltered truth about money, investing, and retirement planning from a man who will give it to you straight. No bias and no spin. Here he is, David Holland.
Brace yourself, ladies and gentlemen. Don't worry about me. Worry about the market. And I'm telling you, wow, what a week. What a day Friday was. And of course, here to tell it, to live to tell, is the man, the myth, the legend, the Scott Conner who loves when I talk about him.
The fastest 5 minutes in finance with Scott Conner.
There you are. That's your tee up.
All right.
You better make good on this, man.
Well, Friday's trade was some trade, wasn't it? We saw it coming. We spoke the previous day about how the market was expecting 150,000 jobs, and I was the bearish person I knew. It said 96,000, 97,000, and it came in significantly lower than that. But to give you a quick recap for Friday's trade, Dow Jones Industrials down 276 points, closed at 12,118.
Ouch. Okay.
Now in negative territory for the year. S&P down 32 at 1278. NASDAQ down 79 points at 2747. So really the pain was spread around pretty evenly. Oil down 330 on the day to 83.20. Is it possible we're going to see oil crack 80?
Yeah, we talked about it getting under 80. We said that.
Yeah, a lot of money flowing into gold, up 60 on Friday's trade at 1624. A lot of pressure on 10s at 1.46.
Historic. That one I can't believe.
Yeah, historic record closes on 10-year yields. 30-year yields also reached historic levels. German 2-year bonds, German sovereign 2-year bonds, are trading at negative yield.
I can't believe how low rates are. You said the 10 years are historic lows. That means ever.
Yes.
Okay. So we have reached a new milestone for 10. And why does that matter to people?
It matters to people because it shows us that there is a certain amount of fear or trepidation or nervousness or whatever term you want to use, and investors are looking for safe havens to store cash. It's important to recognize that when people buy 10-year bonds. In the trading environment or in the investing world, in the professional investing world, they're not keeping those bonds for 10 years. They're putting them in there just for the time being, and when they want to take the money out, they'll just sell them. And when they sell them, we'll see yields move up quite a bit, right?
Well, and answer this. When they sell them, will they incur a loss when they sell them?
Possibly.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, they're possibly willing to accept the risk of loss of a little bit versus going somewhere safe with the money.
Yeah, it's just strictly a volatility play. There's significantly less volatility in the tens. And the possibility exists, which I'm sure we'll touch on a little later in the show, that there may be a very, very large buyer of bonds waiting to purchase them from.
Can't imagine who that would be.
A little bit interesting movement in the euro today. The euro up a little bit. 1.243, up 0.007 versus the dollar.
That's because of our market now.
Well, I think it could be, depending on which side of the trade you're on, it could either be shorting the euro coverage or long the dollar profit taking.
And could it also be the expectation of QE?
It could be. It certainly could be.
Okay, we might have another quantitative easing, which, what is that again?
That's basically the Fed pouring money into the system, buying as many bonds as they can. And Fed Chairman Bernanke has been pretty clear that he has said, you know, as long as, if we get into a situation where the economy is stalling, which, I mean,
here we are at stall speed.
So if the economy is stalling and there is not a whole lot of sign of inflation, and with oil prices coming down the way they're coming down, there is no sign of inflation, then they are more likely to engage in more quantitative easing. Now, at the week ahead, starting Monday, we have a lot. We have the Fed Beige Book, and then we also have a lot of speeches by Fed governors throughout the week, Wednesday and Thursday primarily. So the market will be paying much closer attention to those speeches than they normally do to see if there are any kind of inklings of an acknowledgement that they're going to engage in more QE.
Well, at this point, you know, the QE looks like it is more likely. And the other thing that, you know, of course, the Fed has fought in the past and has been part of the QE strategy is the risk of deflation. You know, we've got so much of a, you know, when you look at the total inflation, which includes energy and food, the falling energy prices, with the oil being a major impact, we could see a net deflation on the monthly or annualized numbers.
Right, which I think further increases the QE. A couple of things in Friday's trade that I just want to get to real quick before we move on. We did also, on the economic front, have a number from construction spending, rose less than expected, 0.3%. Institute for Supply Management's Manufacturing Index also came in pretty light, 53.5. Still expansion, but very, very slow. If we look at China, they it looks like their slowdown is starting to worsen. They haven't reached stall speed, but their factories are showing a shrinkage of demand. Also, South Korea announced that exports fell for that country. Looking at the week ahead, we get the Beige Book on Wednesday, ISM non-manufacturing on Tuesday, a bunch of Fed speak, and the jobless claim on Thursday.
China said they don't plan on doing a bunch of stimulus.
Yeah, but they're cagey about it. I mean, they can do stimulus without just coming out and doing it like we do. So I mean, they can fast track projects. They can change bank lending rates. There's a lot that they can do that is quasi stimulus.
Well, it's pretty darn centralized, the control.
Yeah, that's right.
All the levers are in one room, right?
That's right. Yeah. So we'll see. They have said that they have a commitment to do what they can to prevent a hard landing. There's no question that economy is going to continue to slow. My bigger concern for China down the road is how big of a housing bubble or real estate bubble do they have? I think they're a couple of years from actually facing that, though.
Okay. Well, lots more to talk about today, ladies and gentlemen, and we're going to take a quick break. We will be right back. Stay tuned.
Have you noticed most of the financial literature available is either so specific it doesn't apply or too generic to answer even the most basic questions? This revelation inspired David Holland to write his first two books, Confessions of a Financial Planner, Secrets to a Secure Retirement, and How to Get Great Advice and Avoid Financial Scams. These how-to guides contain easily accessible information on a wide variety of topics concerning personal finances. An effortless weekend read. You'll find clarification on what a mutual fund is, how to choose the right financial professional, and much more. Call Holland Financial at 888-747-PLAN to request a free excerpt from David's first book, Secrets to a Secure Retirement. The number again is 888-747-7526. Or visit davidholland.com for more information on this innovative book series.
Now it's time for a breakdown from Finglish to English.
We're back. We're cutting up on the break. Scott and I are being silly. You caught us almost. So, Scott, speaking of cutting up or a thousand cuts, death by a thousand cuts for this market, what's next?
Well, let's get to the jobs report because we really haven't talked about it in any real depth here. The market was looking for 150,000 or maybe 158,000 new jobs created for the month of May, and what we got was 69,000 jobs. Unemployment rate stayed unchanged at 8.2%. Not good.
Now, again, riddle me this. Don't we have to have about 100,000 just to break even?
Well, we do, and we actually didn't get a number even as good as it sounded today because they went back and revised March and April downward. So the 69,000 jobs or so that they said were created, count that to be more like 40,000.
Well, hold on. Now, that's as is without revising the 69. So next month when they revise the 69...
Yeah, it certainly could. It's there really was nothing good in this report. If you take discouraged workers who are employed, unemployed workers who would like to have a job but have just plain old given up looking, that rate goes to about 14.8%.
So real unemployment percentage-wise is about 15%.
About 15%, yeah.
Now, what about the number that they talk about that's kind of in addition to that, which is the underemployment, the people that are working a part-time job?
Yeah.
Like the guy I told everybody about that was working at the Sunglass Hut, who had been in technology, got laid off, and worked at Sunglass Hut because he was not going to sit back and not do anything.
Yeah, well, there are a couple other numbers in there. Part-time for economic reason, which is what you're talking about, up to 8.1 million. That's the total number. And then also 2.4 million people, what they call marginally attached to the labor force. Those are folks who are in the labor force and they want work and they're available for work. They have looked for a job sometime in the last 12 months, but not in the preceding 4 weeks. So those are folks who have recently given up, let's say that.
I think everybody gets it, but let's be clear. These numbers seem to be fairly malleable.
Very.
And I'm not developing a big sense of confidence. There's two things here. It's not just that the numbers are low, but they're not really all that reliable.
Yeah, I mean, I think over time they are. I think from a month-to-month standpoint, they aren't, although I'm going to talk to you in a second about the census, which has a big impact.
Well, and you also were watching, I know you were looking at the labor secretary when she made her speech on Friday.
Yeah, she makes a speech, usually the speech is 8:35, but the speech on Friday was 9:35 because they had to kind of get their act together. And I was speaking with a colleague earlier and said, basically, you know, it's okay that we don't have jobs this month, but what I don't see is a plan. And when the labor secretary spoke this morning, it was, well, we inherited the problem and Congress is not cooperating. And that's...
So it's always somebody else's fault.
Yeah, but there's just all...
How long can you say that?
Well, they can blame whoever they want. I don't care about that. But what I do want them to say is, well, here we recognize this problem and here's the plan. This is what we're going to do. And we don't have that. There was some talk on Friday about making things easier for returning vets, you know, to get jobs and encouraging employers. That's terrific. But, you know, let's go.
Okay, that's one. What else
you
got?
Yeah, let's go. We need.
Is that it? That's all you got? Okay.
But some areas of highlight in the report, I guess if you could call it that, healthcare employment is on the increase, plus 33,000 in healthcare. Manufacturing up about 12,000, where we're seeing, you know, this, and it just shows you how things are tied in. Construction employment down 28,000 in May is still a result of the continuing bottom process of the housing market.
That super wide U.
Yeah, super wide U. That's 28,000 jobs lost in construction. That's a lot.
Any more big mass layoffs that we've seen? Not as many, or are they still coming along? A lot. I mean, this unemployment number being driven by more layoffs and on a large
Yeah,
basis.
Not so much. And we do actually get a job cuts report, which we got on Wednesday. That wasn't too terribly
bad.
Okay. But there are sectors of the employable workforce. You know, we talk about Spain, and can you imagine working in Spain where the unemployment rate is such and such and such and such? For teenagers 16 to 19 years old, the unemployment rate is 24%.
Here?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because over Spain, it's 50%.
Yeah, but still, 24% is an outrageous number. When I was in high school, I had two or three jobs, and if I wanted more, there were more out there. But, you know, that's...
Yeah, but that was a long time ago.
Got out of here. It wasn't that long ago. So there are pockets of... areas that aren't very good. Now you asked me to compare this data to 2008.
Yeah, Scott did homework.
So the civilian non-institutional population, which means basically people who are over the age of 16, they're not in jail, they're not in an institution, they're physically capable of working, 239 million people.
Okay.
Now of that, in the labor force, 153 million.
Now is this the 2008 numbers?
These are the 2012 numbers that we got Friday.
Okay.
So the civilian labor force, which means people who are capable of working, who are looking for working, have, you know, 153 million. Of those who are actually employed, 139 million. Not in the labor force, 85 million.
Okay.
All right. Now, the 2008 number, civilian labor force, 154 million. Employed, 143 million. Unemployed, 11 million. Not in the labor force, 80 million. So it's your civilian non-institutional population, 234 million. Remarkably similar numbers.
So where we were in 2008.
Yeah, except that in 2008 we were still on the way down. Now we're basically flat. So maybe we're in an extended U. However, we have to keep in mind that the 2008 numbers were based on the 2000 census.
All right.
The 2012 numbers are based on the 2010 census. And they made an adjustment. We talked about this. They made an adjustment when they enacted the 2010 census that they basically said, well, the population increased by about 160,000, but the workforce decreased by about 160,000. So that was actually a reduction of about almost a third of a million people when you net it all out.
My head's starting to hurt, Scott.
Well, those are the numbers that are in the report. And the more you dig into the numbers, the more you realize we just aren't getting anywhere.
And that's really the bottom line. And I think that's what people need to hear is that, so all of this analysis, our resident CFA, Scott knows I like to throw that out to you because I want you guys to know that Scott knows what he's talking about. Chartered Financial Analysis, doing the analysis, looking at these labor numbers and saying, we aren't getting anywhere. We're really where we were after all the hoopla and the fuss, and we're just about to turn the corner. We're almost out of it. The momentum's building, and where were we in 2008?
Four years. I mean, there was a lot of pain in between, but, you know, then those numbers that I just gave you were end of year 2008 numbers. So it wasn't like beginning of year 2008. And remember, right, we really hit the bottom first part of 2009.
You're right, March.
Right? So, you know,
March 6th.
I let you handle the political stuff on the show, but for me, we're not where we had the potential to be.
It's not where we hoped we would be.
Yeah.
Yeah, and people know on the show that I am a fiscal conservative. I'm not far extreme any direction, but I am fiscal conservative, and that means that I'm looking at this and saying, how do we right our country? And we need to look for some smart fiscal policies that doesn't mean soaking the people that have assets, because I don't think that's the way to do it. I think we got to grow our way out of this because we're not seeing the growth. We see overseas the craziness of extreme, trying to go extreme on austerity, and even, you know, we talked about this, even Frank Holland, that you can do the French pronunciation.
François Hollande?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll say Frank Holland. He is saying, you know what? We got to grow our way out.
Yeah. Yeah, they definitely have had a change in tone there. And to me, more jobs solves everything. If we're getting 400, 300, even 300,000 jobs a month, it solves everything. There's more money for people to spend. There's more infrastructure. There's more hiring. There's more demand. There's more everything. More people buying houses. The shadow inventory of houses starts to go away.
So we need jobs, and we need to talk about, and let's talk about that when we get back from a break. We'll talk about some ways to do that, and I've got a couple other things I want to ask your opinion about. Stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen.
Did you know living longer could be the death of your retirement? According to the U.S. Census Bureau, babies born today can expect to live until an average age of 78. Whether you're retiring today, tomorrow, or in 20 years, you must ask yourself, will your retirement plan go the distance? Holland Financial is ready to help. Call 888-747-PLAN to schedule your free consultation or visit us at davidholland.com.
We're back, and I'm in the studio with our very practical, pragmatic Scott Connor, who we are saying, asking ourselves the question, how do we get our country back on track? Because, you know, sounds like everything's slowing, or at least the job market. Now, I thought you mentioned you're going to have something, some good news about the auto. Did I miss it?
No, I didn't give it to you yet, but I do have some.
All right. Give me some good news, because we have friends in the automobile industry.
Actually, the numbers in the automobile industry, it speaks much more to manufacturing. Well, manufacturing and sales really are good across the board. Big three automakers on Friday all announced double-digit growth over the same period the previous year.
Okay, that's good.
Yeah, it's terrific. General Motors said U.S. sales of new cars up 11%, Buick and GM vehicles 19% higher, Chevrolet up 10%, and even the foreign makers, Toyota rebounded really strongly. Remember last year they were fighting the tsunami, and Volkswagen had its best month almost ever. So people are buying cars.
Well, part of that is, of course, they only can go so long without not, because they've got the clunker that just won't even start anymore.
Yeah, and the average car on the road right now is at a very, very high period. It's like 7.5 years old, something like that, which is really, really high, historically speaking.
And
credit is easy.
Credit is easy.
For cars.
That was going to be my next thing. Credit's not so easy for houses.
Yeah.
A lot of people still doing houses with cash or whatever they do.
And volatile oil prices cause people to change their car.
It'll be interesting to see how people change their habits if we see it go, if it cracks the 80 level on oil and things start to really, you know, we get back to $3. What do you think?
Well, we're Americans. We buy big cars.
We like it. We need a lot of room. We like the big cars. I drive the biggest thing I could find just because I worry about somebody running into me. And yeah. I want to have, you know, I took physics in high school, and force equals mass times acceleration. So I want to have the biggest mass thing I've got so that somebody runs into me, I'm more protected.
Yeah, but definitely some good news from the autos. And there is, you know, there is good news here and there. Remember, corporate earnings, we just got through an earnings season not too long ago, were terrific. Valuations in the stock market are very low. But
It's lack of confidence.
It doesn't mean you can't have a day like we had on Friday, which was not such a great day.
This is about lack of confidence. I think, you know, business owners, and again, we are recognizing that there is a lot of political implications here. I think business owners have been nervous for a full year. And I'll just say it like it is. Last year, the president came out and he made a speech on July 25th, 2011. And he was pretty clear that his goals were to raise taxes. And there was a lot of concern about some of the things he said related to healthcare. And so I think business owners are generally nervous. And so I think we're seeing some of that translate through in the economy.
Yeah, and also just more specific to the stock market, we have the possible specter of dividend and capital gains taxes increase. The stock market is not at all interested in that. There's another debt ceiling debate coming up. The stock market is not at all interested in going through that again. So there are some significant reasons on the horizon to maybe take some risk off the table.
I think people may not fully really, a lot of people may not really get, they say, well, yeah, you know, people that make more money, they should pay more. Well, somebody making $1 million versus somebody making $100,000 or somebody making $500 versus $50, they're paying more than 10 times the tax. And so if we say, well, hey, let's tax them even more, that's where those are the folks that are investing. Those are the folks that are buying things, that are building things. And this whole thing with the 2013 tax, if they can't all get together and agree, the taxes go up from the highest tax bracket right now is 35%. It goes from 35 up to 39.6, 40%. And on top of that, there's a healthcare tax. So somebody literally can, and for the person investing in dividend paying stocks, which is the Dow and these other stocks market indices that we follow, they're going to see your current capital, your current ordinary income tax bracket is very low. And could double.
Yeah, and where are people going to go for income? If 10-year treasuries are paying 1.5% and dividends are taxed, and where are retirees going to get income?
Well, they're going to say, okay, well, I'll tell you, well, exactly, that's a good question. I know it's a little rhetorical, but I'm going to answer it anyway. They're going to say, okay, can I go to CDs?
Not if 10s are at 1.5%.
Well, and CDs are at 1 already.
Yeah.
5-year CD, I was looking at USA Today, average is like 1.1, 1.2. So, not so good. Bonds, again, your answer is the 10-year treasuries are 1.5.
Yeah.
So your corporate bond is what? 3?
Well, if you go way down the credit scale, if you go down to a BBB, you can get a 5-year for 3.
Okay. That's not very exciting.
Well, it's BBB. It's a step away from junk.
You've got some risk. So if you go quality, what do you got?
It's not too far off of treasuries. Yeah, maybe.
1.5, 2?
Yeah.
Munis, same thing, right?
Yeah, the rally in muni pricing has been outrageous.
So where are the yields there? You got to go long term too, right?
Yeah, plus if you're a Florida investor, there's not a whole lot of point in buying munis because we don't have a state income tax, so you're taking a hit on the yield for nothing.
All right, and what else you got? Now, I can go over on the insurance product side. There are some good quality products over there, but you need to make a commitment. It's not going to be as liquid. You know, you can go to a fixed annuity or something with an income guarantee, which we use for our clients. I like them. They're great for income, but it's not going to be...
But they're not exempt from interest rate sensitivity.
Well, if you draw an income guarantee, your income is guaranteed and you have a fixed product. And so the interest can be tied to a fixed rate or it can vary. But I think what this does is it does tighten up people's choices. And we've talked a lot about people being, you know, what's going to happen when interest rates do go up. It's not going to be pretty.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take another break and we'll come back and reload. And I've got a couple more things to ask Scott. Stay tuned.
There are hundreds of annuities available in today's marketplace. How can you know if one is right for you? Certified financial planner David Holland answers this question and more in his educational booklet on annuities. To get your free copy, call Holland Financial at 888-747-PLAN. The annuity booklet provides a plain English explanation of the different types of annuities so you can decide if one is a good fit for your situation. Again, that number is 888-747-7526.
We're back, and Scott and I are beating it up today, you know, kind of basking or, I guess, reflecting on the markets just fairly significant drop in the bad news that we saw with the unemployment numbers. And right before the break, we're talking about ways to get income. I want you to know this, though. If you are trying to get income, there are definitely ways to do that. We can build a financial plan. I don't want you to think that we're throwing in the towel any way, shape, or form. It's just frustrating, I think, for a lot of people, Scott, that they see these things and are like, you know, I want to save. I want to have a plan. And so what they need to do, there's never been a more important time for people to have a financial plan. If you need income, then we can look at an annuity or we can look at a bond portfolio, but we've got to be very, very careful how we do this because things are going to change and we have to be prepared for that. Now, I know you had some other stuff from corporate news you wanted to get to.
Yeah, I want to tell you about Groupon because it is a lesson of things to come. So remember, Groupon did their IPO not too long ago, and the stock on Friday's trade was down significantly. It was down 10%, and maybe even a little bit more by the time the close. I didn't double check it, but inside of $10, that's a significant drop from its original IPO price, about 50% down from its original IPO price. The main reason that it was under so much pressure on Friday was because the so-called lockup period expires.
Oh, really?
And what that means is that there are a lot of shares out there that institutions hold, that executives hold, former employers hold, employees hold, that they can't sell on the day of the IPO.
They've got to wait 90, 180 days.
Yeah, it depends. Sometimes 90, 180, or sometimes even a year, but usually 90 and 180. And so Friday was the first day that lockup period went away, and all of a sudden there were all these other shares that were available to come out and trade on the market.
It was a lot of shares because their average volume has been about 3.5 million shares, and the volume for Friday was over 23 million shares.
Right, and that's what you saw was a flood. That was a flood of supply, which caused the stock to come down to 969 at the close, down 9%. The reason I bring that up is because with the Facebook shares, let me give you some numbers for the Facebook shares. On the original IPO, they authorized 2.1 billion shares, means that there are now all of a sudden there are 2.1 billion shares somewhere. Some are trading, some aren't. The number that originally traded, the so-called float, the initial float, somewhere between 400 and 500 million or so.
Okay.
Which is a pretty small percentage of 2.1 billion.
So there's another 75% of the stock that still can
Let me give you the specifics here.
Okay.
In 91 days from the IPO, 268 million shares come off a lockup. Okay, between 90 days and 180 days, another 137 million shares come off the lockup. 6 months after the IPO, 1.2 billion shares come off the lockup. So if you're holding shares 5 months and 28 days after the IPO of Facebook, your next couple of days are probably going to be pretty rough days. I only say this because a lot of stuff happens in the market that we never see coming. A lot of stuff happens that we think is probably going to come, like the jobs number that we talked about.
We were expecting it.
Some stuff you just know is going to happen. 6 months from the date of the IPO share, if 1.2 billion shares of Facebook come on the market, I mean, it's simple supply and demand. You've got a ton of supply.
Well, and here's the thing. You say, well, hey, maybe these 1.2 could be sold, but they might not be. But guess what?
Right.
Some of them are.
That's right. Now, they most certainly will not all be, but a good percentage of them will be. And the market, you know, the market doesn't usually, if I can see it coming, the market can see it coming, right? So one of the reasons that we've seen this share price come down and down and down and down and down is because the market knows this. They're not going to wait for 6 months after the IPO and then say, oh my goodness, all these shares are coming off. So what you're seeing is institutions pairing their holdings off because they know 6 months after the IPO, there's a huge wave of supply coming.
Well, and let me make sure I understand when we're talking about this, Scott. When we say the market, what we're really talking about are guys like you. There are guys all over the country, these CFAs and other investment professionals that are saying, okay, what am I going to do for my clients? And you're placing trades and you're building portfolios. And so the market is not Skynet or Vicky and iRobot or some sort of amorphous entity. It's a collection of everybody acting on the market and placing trades and doing the things they're going to do.
Right.
So there are a bunch of other smart guys like you who are saying, you know what? 1.2 billion shares on Facebook are going to come on the market. So you know what I'm going to do for my clients? Yeah, we bought it at the IPO, but we're going to get out.
Yeah.
Now, thankfully, we didn't buy it for our clients.
Right.
But that's what's happening. So this portends of a continued pressure.
Yeah, and something's
Facebook.
Open to interpretation. Some things are not. 1.2 billion shares coming to the market is not open to interpretation.
All right, that's pretty clear, ladies and gentlemen. Well, there you have it. We hope that helps, and we will be back.
Want to learn more about Real Money with David Holland? Visit us at realmoneyradio.com, where you can listen live or to the archives. You can also email us your questions, comments, or show ideas to info@realmoneyradio.com. Be sure to like us on Facebook at Real Money with David Holland and keep up with Scott Connor by following us on Twitter at Real Money Radio.
Remember, nobody cares more about your money than you do. This has been Real Money with David Holland. Thank you for listening.